From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Rat Pack. Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Joey Bishop, and Peter Lawford. They're icons in the lounge music and cocktail revivals. We'll hear from actor Joe Mantegna, who plays Dean Martin in the new film The Rat Pack, which premieres Saturday night on HBO. And we'll talk with Sean Levy, who chronicles the Rat Pack's heyday from 1958 to 63 in his new book, Rat Pack Confidential. Also, President Clinton has said he misled the American public. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the reaction that this is all about semantics. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Southern African countries are divided over whether to give military aid to the Democratic Republic of Congo. This debate comes as rebels continue to advance on the capital, Kinshasa. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe says material and manpower should be sent as soon as possible to try to put down the rebellion. But South African President Nelson Mandela says that would only worsen the situation. He's pushing for negotiations. The very debate reflects the regional rift sparked by the conflict. The rebels in Congo are believed to have support from Rwanda and Uganda. Southern African countries who align themselves against the rebels will also be confronting former allies. In Kinshasa, sporadic shooting overnight continued into this morning. One firefight centered on a prison where conflicting reports say inmates either tried to escape or were freed by a group of rebellious soldiers. I'm Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Kinshasa.
The chief of Northern Ireland's political party, Sinn Féin, is pleading with all Irish Republican Army groups to renounce violence. The call by Gerry Adams comes after an IRA dissident group known as the Real IRA claimed responsibility for a car bombing last weekend that killed 28 people, mostly women and children. The Real IRA today said it had adopted a ceasefire. 16 more funerals will be held for car bomb victims today. The Irish president and two Sinn Féin leaders are also paying their respects to the dead. FBI investigators in Kenya are still gathering evidence at a Nairobi hotel. They suspect a bomb was built there and then used to blow up the U.S. embassy in the city. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from Nairobi.
The FBI says searches were conducted yesterday at the Hilltop Hotel near the city center, but will give no further details. Several hotel employees say the FBI and Kenyan police arrived there yesterday around 11 a.m., stayed for nearly 2.5 hours, then left with a box full of evidence, the hotel registry, and the hotel manager, a Kenyan named James Nganga. Two rooms at the hotel, one on the first floor, the other on the second, appear to have been given the closest scrutiny. Blackened smudges on the desktops, light switches, and closet doors show where investigators looked for fingerprints and other clues. The Nairobi Daily Nation newspaper, quoting unnamed sources, today reported that the suspect returned here from Pakistan 5 days ago, Mohammed Sadiq O'Day, has confessed to being the mastermind of the attack, and that the bomb was made at the Hilltop by O'Day and several colleagues who checked in 3 or 4 days before the blast. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, Nairobi.
Independent prosecutor Kenneth Starr has asked Monica Lewinsky to return before the grand jury. She's been asked to return tomorrow, 3 days after President Clinton dramatically admitted he had an inappropriate relationship with her. On Wall Street, the Dow was down. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the markets moved higher shortly after today's opening bell, but there are some signs that markets may be ready to take a breather. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
After back-to-back triple-digit gains, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has been moving in a much more narrow range today. Investors are still concerned about the volatility of foreign markets. It was also a big surprise on the economic front today. The Commerce Department reported that housing starts in July took their biggest bump up in more than a decade, rising by 5.7%. That followed a similar rise the month before. Demand for homes remains robust, with interest rates at or near decade-low levels. Among the stocks moving higher today, shares of Dell Computer, which announced positive second-quarter earnings after the stock market had closed yesterday. The company also announced a 2-for-1 stock split and confirmed it has now moved past rival Compaq as the number one seller of desktop PCs with more than 14% of the market. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Russian banks are apparently in trouble. A leading Russian banker says his government must act at once to head off panic. This week, the Russian government allowed the national currency, the ruble, to devalue. The ruble immediately lost a third of its value. Some analysts warn a third of Russian banks could fail, mainly because they rely heavily on ruble-based assets. British Airways is issuing a new policy intended to restrain abusive airline passengers. Officials say they've seen a 400% increase in problems with angry and belligerent passengers. Now, if a passenger becomes unruly, a flight attendant will hand that person a yellow warning card. This will caution the person he or she is subject to arrest. Further, if the pilot is forced to divert the plane to the nearest airport to deal with a passenger, he or she will be billed. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Ladies and gentlemen, direct from the bar at the Sands Hotel, Mr. Dean Martin!
How'd all these people get in my room?
That's my guest Joe Mantegna as Dean Martin in a scene from the new HBO movie The Rat Pack. It debuts on the cable network Saturday night. Ray Liotta plays Frank Sinatra, Don Cheadle as Sammy Davis Jr., Bobby Slayton as Joey Bishop, and Angus McFadden is Peter Lawford. The new film dramatizes how these performers came to be known as the Rat Pack. It shows how they reigned supreme in the Las Vegas of the late 50s and early 60s, and how they got in good with the mob and the Kennedy campaign, and lived out the male fantasy of the swingin' party life, which of course revolved around booze, women, money, and power. Joe Mantegna is best known for his roles in the movies House of Games, Godfather 3, Searching for Bobby Fischer, and Bugsy, and for his Tony Award-winning performance in the David Mamet play Glengarry Glen Ross. Here he is again as Dean Martin. His performance is about to be interrupted by some of his fellow rats.
Maestro, how long have I been out? You with the stars in your eyes, love never made a fool of you. You look. There they are, folks. Tarzan, Jane, and the African Queen.
Joe Mantegna, welcome back to Fresh Air. How did you get the part of Dean Martin? Had you ever thought of yourself as the Dino type?
Yeah, I've certainly got a lot of uncles that think of themselves as the Dino type. I've been a great admirer of his ever since I was a little kid. I mean, being an Italian-American myself, he was a big part of my culture growing up. I mean, there was always like Dean Martin records and Frank Sinatra records and Tony Bennett records playing around my house and my relatives' homes. And so he was always part of my life, and the movies, the Jerry Lewis movies with him, and all that stuff. So he, when the project came about, and my agent called me and said there was some interest in them seeing me about portraying Dean Martin, there was a, you know, I definitely piqued my interest.
In portraying Dean Martin, what were some of the most important physical characteristics that you wanted to get across?
Well, thank God I still have plenty of hair, so that helped. So I it was a fairly extensive hair thing. My hair is fairly straight, and so he had those pretty well-known kind of curls and waves. So there was quite a job done on that, and a little tinting to maybe take out some of the gray I've got creeping in, but that and then wonderful makeup people. You know, the Westmores are very famous makeup people here in Hollywood. And so we had a father-daughter team of Candace and Marvin Westmore, you know, working on just subtle things, you know, just even the shape of eyebrows and stuff like that. And amazingly so, I mean, when it was all done, they took some stills and some black and white photos. And I actually, even one of the black and white photos, I know I had was able to show to some of the Martin family, some of the children, And, you know, one comment by the daughter was that, you know, she really, for a second, when she first saw the shot, thought it was a photo of her dad. And that was, you know, at least it made me feel good about that. I felt that I was at least in the ballpark.
Dean Martin had a kind of almost lazy way of speaking. What did you do to get his voice?
Well, there is a certain aspect about where you just kind of relax a little bit, and there's somewhere across between Bing Crosby and the Sugar Bear, you know. So you kind of get caught between doing a Sugar Crisp commercial and and doing a little bit of, because he was a great admirer, actually, of Bing Crosby, and I think there were occasions where he even admitted that he somewhat emulated his singing style, which was a very relaxed kind of thing. So, I mean, Dean was from Steubenville, Ohio. I don't know how much of an accent that causes in one's speech patterns or whatever, but his singing pretty much was an extension of his kind of speaking voice. So, I mean, whatever that kind of, you know, so he can very easily go from something like this into, you know, what's so bad? You know, I mean, so without, you know, I don't pretend to be the singer he was, but whatever. It's just trying to get a little semblance of that kind of lilt and that kind of, you know, relaxed kind of sound he had.
Did you do your own singing for the movie?
I did. As to how much was actually used, I don't know. There wasn't actually that much singing that I had to do because it's pretty spotty within the context, because it's really not a, I think people, a lot of people will be surprised that it's not really a musical piece, that it's very much a dramatic piece about a couple of years in the lives of these guys and a lot of the political and social kind of things that they were involved in at the time. But some of the singing I did do, and I would imagine they may have used a bit of it. Mm-hmm.
My guess is that they used your singing for Hey There.
Yeah, I think from what I've heard, at least in the final cut, that they did. Yeah, so that pretty, I believe that was me singing that, you know, Hey There, you with the stars in your eyes. So something along that line, yeah.
When you were doing research to play Dean Martin, did anything surprise you? Did anything contradict the image that you had of him?
Well, as you inferred, he did have that kind of lackadaisical, kind of easygoing image about him, and it seemed, in fact, that there was a lot to that. I mean, he was a guy that really pretty much walked his own way. I initially made an analogy about them as I did my research, and also as I prepared to do the role, I thought to myself, well, what kind of analogy can I make so I can fit where Dean fits in with this group, the Rat Pack? And what I came up with is that if instead of thinking of them as a rat pack, if we think of them more as, like, let's say they were a pack of dogs, then Frank would be the lead dog, of course, and Dean would probably be the cat that ran with the dogs. And in terms of a surprise, I guess part of it, one thing I was somewhat surprised, not really surprised, but it was found interesting, was just how successful he was comparatively, in the sense that I think Sinatra, being the huge giant that he was, you know, everybody assumed that, well, he left a huge empire and all that. But I think what a lot of people maybe wouldn't know is that Dean was such very astute in terms of his business. And at least according to one source I read, when all was said and done, he was like the largest single stockholder of RCA Victor stock in the world. And a lot of it was due to the fact of his success in television, which even Frank Sinatra couldn't match, in the sense that Frank really never had a popular television show, while Dean had a very popular television show for a good amount of time. And the kind of remuneration he made during that time, based on stocks and stuff, really, you know, helped him create quite a little empire there. So it wasn't just a guy that everybody had this image of, a guy, you know, smoking a cigarette and drinking, which a lot of that was not even true. I mean, he very often had apple juice in a glass, which I think is even somewhat indicated in the show, that when people see the show, they'll see certain things about these guys that probably they didn't know about.
The guys in the Rat Pack were not only showbiz leaders, they were very offensive in their own way, sexist and homophobic, making all kinds of ethnic jokes. And in fact, there's a really good scene in the film that shows this kind of humor. Let's hear an excerpt of this scene, and we'll hear Ray Liotta as Sinatra, my guest Joe Mantegna as Dean Martin, Don Cheadle as Sammy Davis, and Bobby Slayton as Jerry Bishop.
Let me me help you out here a little. How about some lunch?
Frank, do you know how to make a fruit cordial?
No, Dean. How do you make a fruit cordial?
You'd be nice to him.
Do you believe in fairy godmothers?
No, but I have an uncle that I'm keeping an eye on.
Look at these two, ladies and gentlemen, the Italian bookends. Pretty soon they'll be telling you what wonderful work the mafia's been doing.
Hey.
Have you ever seen a jiu-jitsu?
Hey. Now, be fair. That's all I ask. How'd you like it if I said, have you ever seen a wopsicle?
Hey.
Oh, Jesus. Sorry, Frank, it's the boss.
I'm not really part of the show, folks. I just couldn't get a reservation. Two Italians against one Jew, Sammy. Come over here, I need your help. Get another Jew up here.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sammy Davis Jr. And
hurry up here, Sam. Your watermelon's getting warm.
It's better than eating pizza every night.
Yeah, well, at least we don't have to spit out the crust.
Joe Mantegna, how did this kind of humor strike you in its time in the 60s? Did you think it was cool? Did it offend you?
It absolutely was cool, and it absolutely did not offend me because words like sexist and homophobic and things like that didn't really exist in the 60s. But I think that's okay. And I mean, I think that in a way that's part of the reason why there seems to be almost a resurgence and a interest in that time and in a movie like this and about these kinds of guys. Not because we're condoning it and saying, oh, that's what we should be doing now, but I think it's almost like a nostalgic look at a time past when, you know, it was okay to call girls broads, and it was okay to smoke cigarettes, and it was okay to drink martinis and to make those kinds of jokes because we didn't know any better. So, I mean, I think we can almost look back on it fondly and realize that there was a certain kind of innocence involved with it.
My guest is Joe Mantegna. He plays Dean Martin in the new HBO film, The Rat Pack. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joe Mantegna. He plays Dean Martin in the new HBO film, The Rat Pack. Did you get to talk to Dean Martin's friends or family?
Yeah, I did get to talk to people who knew him and worked with him, and I did get to talk to some of his family members.
What are some of the things that they told you that you wanted to hold on to?
I was interested in things that maybe they would know that no one else could possibly know, like, did he like to wear jewelry? If he did, what kind of jewelry did he wear? Did he have any little quirks, little things that maybe you remember about him that would just be, you know, insignificant to somebody else, but something that you were always aware of? And so when you get this kind of information and then you team it along with more documented kind of or obvious information, it helps you as an actor anyway round out the character so that not only on the larger scale, hopefully you have a look that perhaps looks a little like the character, a sound that sounds a little like the character, and you're doing, you know, actions that are somewhat as people remember them. But then on the other hand, you're doing little things that maybe only you know, that you're wearing a certain kind of watch or a certain kind of ring, or you're wearing your hair a certain way, or using little comments that only somebody who was really in the inner circle would know, that they would maybe use those little pet names or comments. So that just helps you feel more comfortable in stepping into those shoes, because it's always harder to play a person who really existed in life as an actor than it is to just create a character that basically the viewing public has to accept, well, this is the character, because there's nobody to, you know, this person has created it. It's a fictitious character.
But what are some of the comments or pet names or quirks that you were able to pick up on from talking with friends and family?
Well, I mean, little things. I mean, I remember watching some old footage of him, you know, doing these Rat Pack routines. And I remember just in one little instance, there was one little joke where all of a sudden Frank Sinatra said something and Dean came back and called him, said something like, oh, yeah, well, Dickie Bird. And he called him Dickie Bird. I don't know what the hell Dickie Bird the reference is or where it came from or what it could possibly mean. But I found it amusing, and so I worked it into the script so that there was an incident where I just used that as a kind of a form of endearment that he used for Sinatra. Now, maybe that was the only time he ever said it to him, was in this one little bit on this one little telecast. But it was something that I felt, okay, this was like a personal thing. And so at least I know in my mind that this is something that really happened. And it's just one more further connection.
Was there jewelry you were wearing because you knew he wore something just like it?
There was a lot of jewelry I wasn't wearing because he didn't wear very much. It was one of the things I found out. So, you know, like they said sometimes he wore one little, necklace with a little, like a religious medal on it. So I often wore it, but you never see it in the movie. But I knew I was wearing it. He wore one kind of a watch very often, which was kind of had like a kind of a gold braided band. I couldn't find exactly that same kind of watch, but it was like, but what was more important was just that he basically just wore the watch, and that was pretty much his only jewelry. Though I think there was a scene or two that maybe I have a little ring on here and there, but it's more like a costume for costume effect that, you know, and I guess that's like a theatrical license thing that maybe he would have worn a ring.
After going through Dean Martin's records and TV shows, and I imagine his movies as well, is there a quintessential Dean Martin image or Dean Martin moment that stands out in your mind?
Well, no, I wouldn't say so. And I think that's part of the enigma of who he was. I mean, there was a quote in there's a wonderful biography on him called Dino. And Nick Tosh's book. And I obviously read that a few times to just glean a lot of different information that was helpful. And there was a quote in there by his wife of 23 years, I believe, the wife he was with the most, the longest, and had three children with. And she said, her quote, I'm paraphrasing it a bit, but her quote was something like, "I met Dean Martin. It was love at first sight. I knew nothing about him. We were married for 23 years. We got divorced. And I still don't know anything about him." And I thought just that quote said a lot. And so that there was a certain kind of enigma that he had. And I mean, I think it's even somewhat inherent in the script and in the movie that we made. And that was one little aspect of his life that, you know, that there's a certain kind of an air of kind of mystery, detachment, a kind of like, you know, I don't think he really wanted a lot of his personal life or a lot of information of really who he was out there. I mean, this is a guy that very often liked to eat alone, would go out alone. Again, it was that analogy I'd made of him. He was very much a cat living in a world of dogs.
There's a scene in the movie where it's like the collage sex scene. Everybody's, I think, at Frank's house, and there's a camera shot in each bedroom, and each of the characters in the movie
seems to be in a hotel, right?
Yeah, there's a hotel, yeah, and they're all, every character in the movie is in their room having sex, except for Dean Martin. He's in his room laying on the bed with a glass of milk in front of the television.
Yeah, well, and this, as I said, and I've got this documented from, you know, people very close who were obviously very close to Dean, who had said that was absolutely in character. That was absolutely something he would have done or had done, and that might be something that to a lot of people at large would be surprised by, that that went against the image of that, you know, devil may care, ladies man kind of guy, the lady killer that was, you know, just out there and, you know, in that world of babes and booze and, you know, but I think it just showed that there was this other side that was no, to the public at large, there was no need for them to know that, and it was just fine.
Was the movie fun to make?
Yeah, the movie was as much fun to make as I think it will be to watch. I mean, I remember clearly on the last day of shooting, we finished something like 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and we all looked at each other, and there was a collective sigh of like, this is going to be a tough one to lay down, because we were having so much fun together. Because we developed a certain kind of camaraderie, just working every day together and playing these guys. You couldn't help it, because there was a lot of fun involved in what they did. And that I got from every source I talked to, that this was no pretend. These guys were having as much fun as it looked like they were having. So how could you not have it, you know, duplicating it, you know, as we did? And we all got along. And I think we all started to feel very protective about the characters we were playing. We got very in a way, defensive about who we were and what we were playing, and we enjoyed it. And it would have been the type of thing that if we all had had the talent, we would have loved to have taken it on the road and done Vegas for, you know, 6 months or, you know, gone to Reno and Vegas and Tahoe. And
Rat Pack Mania.
Yeah, taking the show on the road. But, I mean, but we knew, you know, we knew enough to say, okay, I mean, we can fool them for 2 hours to play these guys. But none of us were, our entertainment-based to the degree of talent these guys had. And but it was a real privilege to play them. And I can safely speak for us all that we really enjoyed doing it.
Joe Mantegna, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Joe Mantegna plays Dean Martin in the new movie The Rat Pack. It premieres on HBO Saturday night. Here's the real Dino.
You're nobody till somebody loves you. You're nobody till somebody cares. You may be king, you may possess the world and its gold, but gold won't bring you happiness when you're growing old. The world still is the same, you never change it. As sure as the stars shine above, you're nobody till somebody loves you. So find yourself somebody to love. Same, you never change it. As sure as the stars shine above, well, you're nobody till somebody loves you. So find yourself somebody to love.
We'll have more on the Rat Pack in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on the Rat Pack. We talk with Sean Levy, whose new book is about what made the Rat Pack so memorable, including the stuff we might prefer to forget. And linguist Jeff Nunberg comments on President Clinton's speech and the pundits' semantic dissections of it. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Sing it again, I didn't hear it.
Well, how many more you think he's going to do, Sam?
Thank you very much.
I don't know, but he sure sing good for a white fella, don't he?
You make me feel so young. You make me feel like spring has sprung. Every time.
That's Frank Sinatra with Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. in the Wings from a 1965 concert. My guest Sean Levy is the author of the new book Rat Pack Confidential, which covers the years 1958 to 63. It's the story of how Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin, Peter Lawford, and Joey Bishop became known as the Rat Pack, got connected with the mob and the Kennedy campaign, and epitomized some of the best and worst of show business. On and off stage, their behavior ranged from very entertaining to incredibly crude. Speaking of crude, here's a scene from the most famous Rat Pack film, Ocean's 11, about 11 World War II vets planning to hold up 5 Las Vegas casinos at midnight on New Year's Eve. While planning the heist, they talk about what they're going to do with the money.
I think I'll buy me some votes and go into politics.
Hey, now that's a good idea, baby boy. You'd make a good notary public. He'd make a better coroner.
One of them laughing coroners.
I'm the one that's going into politics.
What's going to be your platform, Big Sam?
Repeal the 14th and the 20th Amendment. Take the vote away from the women and make slaves out of them.
Hey, now that's something that's real constructive.
Hey, will it cost much? Oh, no, we'd have the price control. No inflation on slaves.
Vote for Sam Harmon. Help stamp out mental health.
You got a better platform?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Pay off your own party. Settle for an appointment.
Yeah, now that's real deep thinking. Gentlemen, I'd like for you to meet our latest senator.
What a terrible thought.
Sean Levy, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
There seems to be this new interest in the Rat Pack tied in with people who are interested in lounge music and cocktail. And so the guys from the Rat Pack are like icons to this group. For years, they epitomized everything that youth culture was against. The Rat Pack epitomized gaudiness and the worst of showbiz values and of womanizing. Why do you think there's such a fascination with the Rat Pack now?
Well, I think a lot of the people who have embraced cocktail culture and the Rat Pack are actually the children of people who rejected it once. So it's kind of like, you know, the grandchildren of immigrants wanting to learn the old world ways. The younger people who are following these trends are looking, I think, for some sort of adult behavior models that don't have to do with the 70s or, you know, with being a hippie. And you go backwards in time, and the Rat Pack were virtually the last adults to rule at the pop culture, you know, bandstand. So I think there's certainly an irony in the posturing, but I think there's a legitimate reason for it too. It's how to behave when you're, you know, hitting your adulthood.
Or how to misbehave.
Exactly. How to have a good time.
Now, why did you want to do the book? Why are you so interested in the Rat Pack?
Well, I grew up, I was born in 1961 in New York in a house where these guys were the gods. And, you know, some other entertainers too, but Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Jerry Lewis, who was the subject of my first book. And when I'd finished writing about Jerry, I was so steeped in this milieu and in the sort of the manners and the you know intricacies of showbiz back then that it just was a very natural progression. And it's a very irresistible story, too, with so many, you know, shady characters and Vegas and the Kennedy campaign. There were just so many sexy topics. It was like a big party in a way.
Now, how did the Rat Pack get started and get its name?
Well, there was a Rat Pack prior to the Sinatra Rat Pack. Humphrey Bogart and his cronies, including Sinatra, had been in Las Vegas for a kind of debauched weekend. They actually went to see Noel Coward at the Desert Inn. And Lauren
don't say that with such derision. I like Noel Coward.
Oh, I love Noel Coward. It's the combination of Noel Coward and the Desert Inn that sort of blows my mind.
Oh.
But Vegas did novelty acts in the 50s like they don't any longer. You could see Louis Armstrong and Robert Merrill at the Sands.
Right.
A billing from who knows where. At any rate, Sinatra and Bogart and these folk were all there. David Niven, I believe, Judy Garland. And Lauren Bacall walked in on them after they'd been partying for a few days and said, "Geez, you all look like a Rat Pack." And a few nights later, she said it to them again. And this time they went through the motions of forming a society with this name, and they had, you know, official titles. They even had stationery. After Bogart's death, Sinatra sort of drew on that energy and put together his own coterie of friends. Some of Bogart's circle were in it, but mostly it was Sinatra's buddies. And the Rat Pack name sort of got dragged along. Frank always hated it, but the alternative was the Klan. And the Klan didn't sound too good once civil rights had started. So the Rat Pack they became. Years later, Frank dismissed it as that stupid phrase, but he could never shake it.
Let me run through some of the people who were in the Rat Pack and get you to briefly describe what their place in that group was, starting with Sinatra.
Sinatra was the padrone, the Pope. They all worked for him. You know, he produced the movies that they made. He owned the record company. He owned the casino, or at least parts of the casino. And he was also the person who set the style. He chose the people. He showed them how to dress, how to order food at a restaurant. He was really the sort of the center of the universe for this group.
Dean Martin.
Dean was like Frank's blood brother. He was the only guy who could consistently tell Frank no when Frank wanted to party at 2 a.m. or when Frank wanted to go into some business deal. And, you know, Dean was a perfect foil for Frank on stage. He'd been Jerry Lewis's straight man, and then Frank became his. Dean was exquisitely funny.
Sammy Davis.
Sammy's the kid brother. You know, Frank always, in the best sense of the word, patronized minority artists. He always had black groups on the act with him. He always had black musicians in his band. And he knew Sammy from when Sammy was a teenager performing with his dad and uncle. So he became the little brother, and he, more than anyone, I think, slavishly imitated Frank's way of life, way of speech, way of dressing.
Peter Lawford.
Poor Peter. Peter was a bridge, you know, between Frank Sinatra and his circle and Jack Kennedy and his circle. Frank explicitly and deliberately made an alliance with Peter to get to the Kennedy campaign. And then when the Kennedys sort of washed their hands of Frank, Frank dumped Peter. So it was a pretty painful relationship for Lawford, I think, on both sides of the equation, because the Kennedys didn't really respect him as a man's man either.
Peter Lawford was married to one of John Kennedy's sisters.
That's right. And it was kind of an embarrassment because he was a man whose movie career had sort of washed out, his TV career had washed out. And then he became known in the Sinatra household, anyhow, as the brother in Lawford. So it was not a position that, you know, demanding a lot of respect, you know, in and of itself.
Okay, and Joey Bishop, the comic.
Well, Joey was the comic, and he was sort of the MC when the Rat Pack performed together in Vegas and Miami. And he was a traffic cop on stage who kept the act going. And I think also he was kind of a beard who, you know, during those years, anyhow, before the sort of darker sides of the whole era became known widely, I think Joey was sort of a way to say, hey, it's showbiz. Joey Bishop is here. What else could it be? This isn't a real life scene. This is an act.
What were some of the most famous shticks within the Rat Pack's stage act?
Oh, gosh. They would perform sort of a pastiche of a nightclub act. One of the three singers would come out and start to sing and be interrupted. Sometimes, you know, really coarsely. You know, it was Vegas. It was, you know, adult entertainment. And things that they said would be sort of outrageous to us now, say, in terms of race or ethnic identity or gender. Sammy, for instance, would get lifted up into the air by Dean or Frank, and they'd go to the mic and say, I'd like to thank the NAACP for this award. You know, we can't imagine laughing at that now, and it would just bring down the house. But they would bring a bar cart out and mix drinks. Dean would always say, you know, I'll make me another salad or something like this. Someone would start to sing a song, and the three or four others would just trample all over it. They worked always toward the same finale. When it was the entire Rat Pack, they sang The Birth of the Blues with special lyrics. And you even see Johnny Carson sing it with them in the 1965 Dismas House special. So it was a routine. It was about an hour and a half show that they could run to 2.5 hours if they were feeling spirited, you know, at the end of the night. Pretty corny old burlesque stuff, though. Nothing as penetrating as Lenny Bruce or Mort Saul.
You know, they made a lot of homophobic jokes and jokes about Jews and blacks and Italians. So they were putting down each other and then also putting down people who were not represented on stage. I think that stuff doesn't play back very well right
no,
now.
No, it doesn't. And surely that's the sort of thing that people objected to, you know, as the 60s went on and people became more aware of the ways in which humor and language could be hurtful. I think that that helped the Rat Pack fall from favor, that they were still, you know, Frank would tell Sammy to hurry up and finish the song "The Watermelon Was Getting Warm," you know, things like that. I mean, that just makes me cringe to, you know, to see. And there's Sammy, you know, slapping his knee the way he does with the open mouth laugh. It's kind of a grisly sight in retrospect.
But it seemed to not bother them at the time.
Well, it didn't bother Frank and Dean at any rate. Sammy, in his autobiography, wrote about knowing that there was a double edge to the humor, but also knowing how Frank had always stood behind him and thinking, well, this is shtick. This is what we do. It's part of an act. His wife at the time, a Swedish actress by the name of Mai Britt, was very upset with Sammy's treatment at the hands of Frank and Dean, even though he always said to her, honey, it's in jest. They're stand-up guys. They don't mean it. She felt it was very demeaning, and she really couldn't make him see that.
The Rat Pack's artistic home was Vegas. What was the role of the Rat Pack in attracting people to Vegas and to in creating the identity of Vegas?
if you speak to old-timers in Vegas, they all credit the Rat Pack with kind of saving the town. In the mid-50s, after the first boom on the Strip, Vegas became built up very quickly. But the tourism wasn't matching the construction. People were still going to Havana to gamble and party. Miami was still a huge entertainment capital as well as a vacation capital. And as Sinatra became more and more associated with Las Vegas, he bought into the Sands Hotel. Dean Martin owned a share of the hotel. He played there more and more. I don't think it's a coincidence that the Rat Pack Summit, the appearance of the five big stars on the stage at the Sands, is roughly around the time that the hotels were nationalized in Havana. You know, Castro took the casinos away from their stateside owners, fellas like Meyer Lansky. And suddenly, there was this big tourist attraction in Las Vegas, the Rat Pack. And the town that had been sort of teetering, was overbuilt and had too many rooms and not enough guests, suddenly seemed a lot more stable. Within a few years, there were more hotels, there was a convention center, and the Rat Pack really are credited by the people in Las Vegas with sort of helping define that change, helping turn things for the city.
Was it just what they did on stage that attracted people to Vegas, or was it their partying and stuff off stage that also helped make the Vegas reputation?
I think it was a little of both. I think, you know, one of the allures of the act was that you didn't really think all the time that you were seeing an act, that it seemed like, hey, this is what they're really like. You know, Vegas was so small then. You know, we think of these monolithic hotels they have there today. The Sands had 200 rooms in 1960, and that was the most luxurious hotel on the Strip. So it was a very tiny place, and these guys would walk around the casino after they performed or on their way to performing. You know, there were no sort of security alleys for them to duck through the way there are in the large hotels today. And I think the idea you could go to Las Vegas and maybe Sammy would show up at the Riviera and get on stage with the lounge act drew a lot of people to the city.
My guest is Sean Levy. He's the author of the book Rat Pack Confidential. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Sean Levy. He's the author of the new book, Rat Pack Confidential. How did Frank Sinatra get involved with JFK, and why did he get involved with JFK?
Well, Frank grew up in a very politicized household. His mom, Dolly, was an operative in the North Jersey political machine. in the 20s and you know throughout Frank's childhood. And Frank was always a very staunch liberal Democrat. In fact, his son, Frank Jr., is actually not a junior. He's Franklin Sinatra, named after FDR. Frank, you know, was always ahead on civil rights. He won an Oscar in the mid-40s for a film about racial harmony called The House I Live In, a short film. In the 50s, he had supported Stevenson, Adlai Stevenson, and he noticed Jack Kennedy in the background. And, you know, as many people did back then, handsome, educated, Pulitzer Prize-winning war hero, up and up, you know, on the upward spiral of his career. And Frank wanted to get close to him. It was a time when Frank's own career had been resuscitated after the sort of terrible depression of the early 50s. And he saw a political rising star that he could hook onto, especially given the fact that Kennedy's brother-in-law was also in showbiz, Peter Lawford.
What did Sinatra do for the Kennedy campaign?
There were alliances between the Kennedys and the Chicago outfit, the mafia in Chicago, at least in a couple of specific political races, the West Virginia primary, and then apparently the November election, the general election of 1960. And it being, you know, even in a media age when the media left things alone, it still would have been very dangerous for someone directly from the Kennedy campaign to make alliances with these people in Chicago. But Frank knew them both. Frank was very friendly with Sam Giancana, who headed the Chicago outfit. And, of course, he knew Joe and Jack Kennedy. And he was asked to serve as kind of a go-between, a facilitator, letting people know on the one side that help was needed and on the other that the help would be reciprocated.
Sinatra, I think, also introduced Kennedy to Judith Campbell.
That's right.
Who Kennedy had an affair with.
Frank had been involved with Judy Campbell, who became known later on by her name, Judith Exner. In the late 50s, she was divorced from a kind of B-movie actor, and she had a trust fund, and she did some painting, and she was kind of a party person, you know, who hung around the scene, and Frank had had a brief affair with her. And then at the Rat Pack Summit, during the filming of Ocean's 11, introduced her to Jack Kennedy. And their affair began. A month later, in Miami, Frank introduced Judy Campbell to Sam Giancana. He also introduced her to Desi Arnaz and some other guys. She, you know, he apparently thought well of her. And that liaison, of course, you know, took off independently. The Kennedy-Exner and Giancana-Exner triangle took off independently of Frank, but he in fact, started it.
But eventually, the Kennedy family cut off Sinatra.
And the reason they cut Sinatra off was that the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, found out about Judy Campbell. She had been surveilled in Chicago and in Los Angeles with gangsters, and they were aware of her contacts with the White House. And when Hoover presented JFK with the evidence saying, you know, here's someone who's involved with you who seems to be involved with organized crime as well. Sinatra, who was, you know, sort of in the same boat, wound up being sunk.
What do you consider to be the end of the Rat Pack?
Well, there's the way I wrote about it is to take a period of time when they were working on a film together. Robin and the Seven Hoods was in production on November 22nd, 1963, when John Kennedy was killed. When that film came out the following August, the Beatles, who had never been in the United States prior to the beginning of the filming, had 5 top 10 hits. And there's the sea change right there. In about an 8 or 9 month span, the whole mystique of, you know, adults and a kind of licentious sort of ribbing lifestyle had been replaced by a very innocent-seeming teenage idealism that, you know, Frank, Dean, Sammy, Peter, they couldn't compete with.
Of course, Sinatra still went on to have hits and to make some really good recordings.
Oh, they all did. They, you know, Dean had his NBC TV series. Sammy was still years away from Candyman and, you know, his biggest hits. But they were playing to a smaller crowd. You know, I've written that they lost the main room and were playing in the lounge. The kids definitely took over the center stage, and they really have ever since. You know, the no adult entertainers have consistently outsold youth acts in the music business ever since the arrival of the Beatles. And in terms of who controls the cultural conversation, I think we still look to youth culture to this day.
How did writing your book affect your opinion of the Rat Pack? Did it change your mind about anybody?
Well, I particularly felt more and more empathy with Sammy Davis Jr. You know, in our time, he's something of a joke, and he ended badly. You know, he was hounded by the IRS. He was, he suffered terrible ill health during the last year or so of his life. And he became kind of shorthand for showbiz insincerity and glitz and sleaze and a lot of bad comedians, made hay out of imitating him. A lot of good ones, too. But when you look at his story, I always thought of him as the Jackie Robinson of showbiz. And you look at what he had to endure. You know, Las Vegas was not an integrated town during most of this Rat Pack period. And Sammy, as a result, was the first black entertainer to be allowed to stay on the Strip, the first black entertainer to be allowed to gamble in the hotels, and on like this. And, we tend to think of him as this kind of little, guy capering around there with Frank and Dean. But when he got off that stage, he was subject to a completely different kind of treatment from the rest of them. And I grew to admire his ability to sort of plow through that and sort of stay true to his intention of being, a great entertainer and a great example to people who he hoped could follow him.
Do you have a favorite recording from the Rat Pack era that you'd like to leave us with?
Oh, well, Frank's first album on Reprise, which was the label he started in the Rat Pack era, was Ring-a-Ding-Ding. And the title song, Ring-a-Ding-Ding, with words by Sammy Kahn, is just perfect cheeky music that really... It's a song almost about nothing, but it's sung with such gusto that it really does encapsulate the best things of the era.
Well, Sean Levy, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sean Levy is the author of the new book, Rat Pack Confidential.
Life is dull. It's nothing but one big lull. Then presto, you do a skull and find that you're reeling. She sighs and you're feeling like the toy on a string. And your heart goes ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding. How could that funny face...
Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on the language the president used to discuss his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. This is Fresh Air. It's been 2 days since President Clinton admitted that he had an inappropriate relationship with Monica Lewinsky. While the pundits continued to dissect the language of Clinton's speech, our linguist Jeff Nunberg says the whole spectacle reminds him of an earlier time in history, centuries ago.
It isn't a very attractive prospect. Starr sends Congress a report saying that the president committed perjury, And then we have to spend several months listening to the Judiciary Committee trying to decide whether Clinton lied when he testified that there was no improper relationship as the thump of dictionaries echoes in the land. It'll be pretty different from the last time we went round on this sort of thing. Watergate, after all, was about matters of fact. What did the president know and when did he know it? But the facts here are pretty clear, or at least as clear as anybody wants them to be. What the committee will be debating now is something else. We know what he did, but what do you call it? The whole thing has a medieval feel to it. You think of one of those assemblies like the Fourth Lateran Council of 1215, where more than 1,000 theologians gathered in France to debate the meanings of terms like chastity and virginity. Was sin entirely a matter of intention? And if so, could you remain a virgin even when you were having intercourse, provided you didn't enjoy it? Indeed, that was the view of a number of medieval philosophers, notably Peter Abelard, the good and great friend of Eloise, who had been there and done that himself and paid for it rather more dearly than Clinton will have to. Recall that those were the days when the appropriate punishment for theft was cutting off a hand. But there's nothing particularly medieval about this sort of semantic preoccupation. If you could plunk Abelard down amongst a bunch of college students rapping about inappropriate relationships, he'd find nothing to fault either in the subtlety of the arguments or the passions that people brought to them. Adolescents know that there are grades of intention and degrees of sin, and that the words you use to describe them to yourself make all the difference when you wake up the morning after. In a general way, in fact, Americans are as deeply semantical a race as the medieval French were. Not even Abelard's contemporaries spent as much time litigating over these matters as we do, and what other nation could have produced a show like Seinfeld, a 9-year celebration of the lexicography of daily life? You wonder what the Seinfeld writers would have done if they'd gotten hold of St. Augustine's notion of a technical virgin. It would have made for a memorable episode. What makes us different from the medievals is that we limit these linguistic preoccupations to melodrama and comedy. When it comes to the high drama of public life, we suddenly abandon our scholastic nominalism and turn into hard-headed realists. All at once, those delicate questions of meaning are dismissed with that damning phrase, mere semantics. It's an expression that Abelard would have found mystifying, to put it mildly. What's so mere about it, anyway? But it pleases us to pretend that we're a people of action who don't have time to stand around bandying words. I have the sense that this is what will save Clinton in the end. It's hard to believe the Republicans will want to go there. We don't have a model for doing this sort of thing seriously. There's no way the proceedings won't come off as trash TV. Is oral sex an improper relation? Does improper mean the same thing as inappropriate? It'll be like watching 8 hours a day of Geraldo or Ricky Lake. It'll hold our attention, but we won't feel exactly edified afterwards. It's lucky for Clinton he wasn't born into the age of Abelard, when people knew how to debate these matters with the high solemnity they deserved. And if he knows the story of Eloise and Abelard, I'm sure he's just as happy that he didn't live in the days before the Eighth Amendment banned cruel and unusual punishment, when he stood to lose more than his job.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist with Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.